This is Judaism Unbound, episode 36, What Jewish Looks Like Today. Welcome back, everyone. I'm Dan Liebenson.
And I'm Lex Rofus.
And we're here today in the fourth sort of wrap-up edition of our four-episode arc on what Jewish looks like today, when we're talking about various kinds of Jews that, as we've been kind of saying, are not the kind of Jews that perhaps Judaism tended to think about as the kind of Jews that we had during the last couple thousand years of its evolution. And really the question that we're trying to explore is, what difference does that make? Positive, negative? What opportunities there are? What challenges there are? And we're really excited today to welcome B'nai Lappi back to the show. We had her on as our very first interview, and she's going to join us for this conversation. But before we get into that, let's talk a little bit, as we often do at the top of these episodes, where we're having a discussion, and just mention that the High Holidays just passed recently, and one of the things that happens often in synagogues at the High Holidays is the High Holiday fundraising appeal. And it brings me back to an idea that Sandra Lawson really talked about, which was that talking about a synagogue in which there were no high holiday ticket prices, but actually the doors were thrown wide open for the high holidays. And there was debate in the synagogue about whether that was a good idea or not, because wouldn't it be important as a fundraising approach to be able to charge tickets for the high holidays? And they had a value that said, no, at this time when Jews really need the high holidays, we need to make it available to everyone without charging for that experience. And that it turned out that that synagogue was able to raise a lot more money from donations that were made by people who are grateful for that opportunity than it ever would have from selling tickets. And that's kind of the philosophy that we're trying to use with Judaism Unbound, that we are providing this show as a free service for anybody who's interested. But we would also ask that for those of you who really are enjoying the show and are feeling part of this community, to support the show, support us so that we can continue to do this. And we've talked about being part of something called Patreon, which is a website that allows people to make recurring monthly donations. And we encourage people to support us maybe at the level of a dollar per show, so $4 or $5 a month. And rather than having to remember a new website, we've now set everything up on our website, so it's much easier. You can go to www.judaismunbound.com/donate. I also want to add, as a kind of public service announcement for our listeners, that today, October 21st, Leonard Cohen has put out a new album called You Want It Darker. In addition to that, a couple of weeks ago, Clayton Christensen put out a book called Competing Against Luck, where he really develops a theory which he calls the jobs to be done theory, which we've talked a little bit about on the show. And I really encourage everybody to read that book. It's truly excellent, and we will definitely be returning to that theory as the show goes on. And now getting into the substance of our show, I guess I should say I don't think that she has any books on the horizon or albums, but another one of my heroes, B'nai Lappi, is with us here today, and we're so excited to have her. We introduced her when she first came on the show in our very first interview. She is the founder and Rosh Yeshiva of Svara, a traditionally radical yeshiva, which is an organization that is doing tremendous work. And again, we're going to come back to B'nai in a few months talking specifically about Svara and her organization that really has made the study of Talmud into a spiritual practice in its own right, particularly around the experience of LGBTQ Jews. So we thought it made a lot of sense to bring you in, B'nai, to help us with this discussion as we kind of look back and process the questions of what kind of experiences people are having with Judaism that, like we've been saying, are not the kind of people that Judaism tended to think about as being the Jews when it was evolving over the last couple thousand years. Before we start the conversation, I just want to also mention that in just a couple of weeks, B'nai is going to be receiving what is kind of regarded as the Nobel Prize in Jewish Education, the Covenant Award. And we're so excited that you're receiving that award, B'nai. It's well-deserved.
Thank you so much. And I'm thrilled to be back.
B'nai, I'd love to hear, since we've got you with us this episode, I'm curious if you have any thoughts on whether it's specifically LGBTQ issues or just the general question of, you know, what Dan termed non-normative Jewish identities, how they fit in the Jewish world today, and sort of where you see positive work happening and where we could take some more steps.
I think the Jewish community's first volley was, you know, all you guys who are different, you're a threat to us. You're not us. And it's going to be not good for us to have you around because you're about something else, or we don't get you, we're afraid of you. Then came, you know, inclusion 1.0. And inclusion 1.0 is sort of, you know, that was the era of being a welcoming congregation. And the idea was, oh, okay, we don't want to be mean, and maybe we owe you something. We don't want to offend you, and we want to be seen as not prejudiced, and we want you to think we're okay. So we're going to welcome you. And it was more than a little bit patronizing. And, you know, at a certain point, that was as far as our imagination could believe what we could get. That was the best we could get. And we thought, yeah, that's great to have welcoming congregations. Wouldn't that be wonderful? And the project was sort of, you know, let's help the poor gay people, and let's be nice to the poor intermarried people because we should be nice. And I hope we're pretty much beyond inclusion 1.0. And because it's so, the word inclusion is so tainted with that patronizing attitude of we're the norm, our values are what they are, and we don't want to question them, and we're okay if you're willing to come into our space and play nice. I don't even think we should use the word, you know, inclusion much anymore. Now the question is, for the gay community, the question is not like, will you give me a place? The question is, are you open to the value that I'm bringing? Do you recognize what you can learn from me? And we who are not sort of in the normative space, need to realize how much we are bringing and really not settle for, you know, like a place, but a place at the table. I think it's wrong-headed for us, for those of us who are not in that normative space, to even be wanting a place back in the center. I'm all about, let's create our own center. I'm not very hopeful about the current center being able to be revived. I know that's a dramatic statement, but I think that's the case.
Well, one thing that Sandra Lawson said that really struck me was this. She said something like, I'm never going to be seen as being at the center. And she was using that as kind of a positive idea. So therefore, but, you know, since I'm someone as an African-American woman, convert, lesbian, you know, whatever, that she would somehow be seen by other people who felt like they were not at the center as like, oh, but she's a rabbi, so that rabbi is like me. And that as a, you know, she was putting that out there, I think, as a kind of positive idea that because she isn't a kind of person who's going to be seen as being at the center, she can therefore appeal to all these other people. But which I agree with, but I just wish that the phraseology of that would be something like, yeah, and we're going to make a new center. And I talked a little bit about this with Josh Lesser. Because of the LGBT experience of having been quite actively excluded, not only from Jewish spaces, but from so many other kinds of spaces, they were forced to create institutions of their own. And a lot of amazing good things happened in those institutions, you know? And so, again, it struck me so much that Sandra is basically saying, you know, because this synagogue is created, founded by people who are gay and lesbian, who are excluded from other Jewish communities, therefore they become radically welcoming. And therefore, you know, an African-American non-Jew who happens to be lesbian, but probably would have also been the case if she weren't, can feel fully embraced in this community and therefore attracted to Judaism. And it seems so clear that that's the case. And then the question becomes sort of, well, what happens if the regular Jewish community becomes, all of a sudden, you know, wakes up and becomes more welcoming, you know, that people won't feel the same need to found those separate institutions because they're now going to be welcomed. And of course, I'm all for that. But on the other hand, there seems to be some loss there.
You know, your question reminds me of an email that I got this morning, and it was from a colleague of mine who sent me a recording of his Rosh Hashanah sermon. And he's gay, and he's openly gay, and he's been openly gay for years, and he was hired as an openly gay rabbi. But he talked in his sermon about a text that we had learned at Queer Talmud Camp, and he said to me in his email, "Thank you for helping me come out. No, I was already out as gay. Everybody knows I'm gay. But in giving this sermon, in using the text that we had learned to advocate for a radical vision of what the world should look like and what justice should look like, what he was saying to me was, I came out as queer in that sermon. And that's a lot harder to do than to just be gay." This colleague of mine is in one of the largest synagogues in the country. And apparently the sermon was received very well. And I don't know, maybe there are places where you can bring to the current center, you know, all of the queerness and all of the radical ideas that live so comfortably and so joyfully and creatively in the external growing centers. But I'm not sure how much that's really possible. And I frankly don't have a lot of hope that no matter how, you know, welcoming and inclusive the center ever gets, it's ever going to embrace a queer normativity and a radical politic and a critique, because that's not what it's about.
Yeah, I think that's a really important thought. And I want to flesh out a little bit of what we're talking about here, because we've mentioned a few groups and we've been emphasizing LGBTQ folks in the last few minutes and in a lot of our discussion. But I want to draw a distinction, or a couple distinctions, because I think there's an important difference between groups who are feeling boxed out of the Jewish community based on their identities. So often these are LGBTQ Jews, Jews of color, people who are being boxed out because of something that they are. And also the sets of people who are being boxed out or feeling boxed out due to reasons of, say, belief. And that can often include folks, as Dan has frequently talked about, who might identify as atheist or maybe agnostic, or just relate to God differently from how a lot of Jewish liturgy does or how a lot of Jewish spaces talk about God. It might be people whose politics veer from what we think of as the norm in Jewish spaces. And that can be pretty prominent on the issue of Zionism. So people who are not Zionist, who struggle to feel fully empowered in certain Jewish spaces, for as one example. And that can be a real issue to think about. And still a third group, which maybe straddles this a little bit, is people who feel boxed out by reasons of sort of life choice or practice. And that, I think, most prominently comes to light through the issue of intermarriage. So people who, it's not that they believe anything that differently from the rest of the Jewish community, or that they have identity markers that are different, but the fact of their intermarriage marks them as different, and often different in a way that many would deem negative. So I think that that distinction is something we should think about, because we can't necessarily work on all of those in the same way. Too often, Jewish organizations that I have connected to are talking about sort of inclusion as one big issue. But I think we would perhaps have more success if we are able to really break down what are the different groups that are feeling boxed out of our community, wrestle with the question of whether the right answer is for them to be part of our community, as we've been discussing, or if we should help them build their own communities. Start with that open question to try and figure it out. And then if the answer is for some communities to try to open up their space, think about, okay, what are the strategies to do that for queer people? What are the strategies to do that for people of color? There will probably be some overlap, by the way, but understanding that each of these issues deserves consideration on its own, I think that we would really benefit from that analysis, because people feeling boxed out due to atheism are going to have different reasons for feeling boxed out than people feeling boxed out because they're a Jew of color. They both often do feel marginalized, but the reasons are different. And also,
the inclusion 1.0 paradigm that you brought up, I think, is so great, because I see it. I wish I was as comfortable as you saying that it's a thing of the past and that we're so mostly beyond it, I think was your language. I see it a lot still. And I see it in terms of with intermarriage, you know, we X denomination will be welcoming, quote unquote, of interfaith folks, but they can't be rabbis. That's, you know, multiple denominations right now. Other denominations, the Orthodoxy, for example, you know, we're not kicking out LGBTQ people from all of our spaces, but they can't do X, Y, or Z in their personal lives, etc. Like, we've got all of the, you know, if you're an anti-Zionist, you can come to Shabbat dinner, but you can't be president of the board. Whatever these different things are, where, you know, we allow you to participate in sort of quote unquote the community, but not necessarily shape it yourself. And I think that inherently that's going to fail, because people aren't interested, any people, whatever their identity, aren't interested in having to put aside, you know, one third of who they are, or one tenth of who they are, or any amount of who they are, in order to participate in a space. It's just not going to happen.
But I think some people actually are. That's one thing that I want to raise here, right? Is that I worry that some people actually are willing to accept a half measure, and I worry, you know, it's partly that I worry for people that are only given a half measure, but I also worry for the community as a whole that there's some way in which by giving a half measure, you can dissipate the energy for change. And this is kind of where I wanted to go a little bit by abstracting from the experience of people that are, let's say, identifiably non-Ashkenormative or, you know, whatever kind of normative, to people that may appear to be more normative than they really are. So therefore, right, I mean, I think that we can maybe understand that for various reasons, people today who are LGBTQ are not willing to hide that in order to join Jewish communities. But I'm thinking about one of the ways in which our podcast has been surprisingly popular among people who are connected to Jewish organizations. You know, I think when we launched this podcast 8-9 months ago, we imagined that we were talking largely about and to people, the people that the Pew study identifies, you know, as these people that are not participating in Jewish organizational life, but that nevertheless, a huge majority of them are proud to be Jewish, say Judaism is important, being Jewish is important in their lives. And, you know, this was a podcast for them. And it turned out that a lot of those people are listening, and we're excited about that. But a lot of people are listening who are involved in Jewish organizations. And in a way, they are people who have accepted a variety of requirements of how to be a Jew in America of the 20th century that didn't allow them to fully flourish as the people who they were. The scientific experts, the literary experts, the atheists that they were, whatever they might be, and they were willing to kind of put that stuff to the side, saying, you know, I'm not allowed to put that front and center when I am participating in Jewish community. So on Shabbat, I pretend like I'm like these other people that are here at synagogue with me because I have various things that I'm trying to achieve by being part of this. I want to be part of this community. I want to be part of this chain of tradition, whatever it was, or, you know, this is just the way I grew up and it feels comfortable for me. And that other stuff, I guess I don't think about it so much on Shabbat. And I think that that's why your work, B'nai, you know, that comes out of the LGBTQ experience has so much spoken to me, you know, because in a way I found myself in it in a different way that said I was not able to be the true me in normative Jewish organizations and practice. And what you showed me is that you can find a way to be the true you, but the way that you have to do it is to build a new practice, a new organization, a new community, And that there was real value to that and real power to that, including the potential power to change the larger community, but only through this work of, as a collective from outside of the normative organizations rather than trying to come inside.
I think Dan's absolutely right. And it's more than just some people. I'm going to guess that the vast majority of people who are playing the established Jewish game are operating at a diminished capacity, their own diminished capacity. And I think Dan's absolutely right. The chaval, the tragedy in that is that we're not able to use all of our potential to recreate and figure out a better way forward. And I think most people are not even conscious of the extent to which they're operating on one engine. And I think we're getting closer to having a solution. I think, you know, going back to my scheme of option one, option two, option three, when there are no attractive options, people leave. But as attractive options start coming up, even though they don't feel authentic and they don't really feel Jewish, little by little, you know, the canaries in the coal mine, the queerest of us, start these new options and build up the options.
So then let me ask you sort of two things that come away from that. So, you know, one is looking at the people that had been excluded in the past who went off and started new organizations or new communities. Now it turns out that what they built is incredible. And now there are all these, you know, straight white guys, you know, Ashkenazi guys wanting to participate. So I think about like me with Svara, you know, Talmud study that's built around and for the experience of, you know, queer people. But then, you know, somebody like me shows up and is like, this is the most incredible thing I've ever seen. I want to be part of it too. And on the one hand, we could say, well, that's a wonderful thing because now we're recentering Judaism in this new place, in this new amazing place. But on the other hand, it has the capacity to now overwhelm the queer experience because there are a lot more straight Ashkenazi men than queer people in Judaism.
I think you're absolutely right. Oh, I have so many thoughts. I don't even know how to order them. Okay, first of all, I don't know where this fits in. But this shul, an Orthodox shul, it was traditional, with Orthodox with mechitzah, but it's become an Orthodox with mechitzah space that's really pushing the boundaries of Orthodoxy, has reorganized itself. And for most of the year, it's a much more exciting place. But on the high holidays, that small group of people meets downstairs in the men's club lounge and turns over the sanctuary to all the people for whom it never worked and still, I don't know if it's going to work, right? It's such an interesting phenomenon. Like, it's like, you know, they still need to be served. So let's give them that same rotten thing that they've come to be used to and want, maybe even to some extent. And they're only going to come on Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur. And then when it's over, you know, those of us who are trying to do something new will come up from the men's club lounge and take over the space again. I don't know. There's something in that.
Well, it's because I think there's something real here. I mean, so there was this recent article by Jay Michelson that he wrote an article saying, don't go to high holiday services.
And
what people sometimes didn't focus as much on is that he also said, go instead to something else over the course of the year that's probably smaller, more joyous, more lively, etc. But I think there's a reason that, like, the bigger the space, the second you have that massive high holiday piece to deal with, you have everybody in the room. You've got the people that are least involved and most involved, and you've got all of their expectations of sort of what it's supposed to be. And what that means is that even if you've got somebody leading it that wants to really work on making something lively and new and experimental and awesome and radical, they probably can't because there's just so much inertia in place dictating what that service looks like. So that, like, you know, slightly shifting two melodies in the whole service is probably what you get. in that, you know, visionary leader's success story. Like one thing I've spent a lot of time thinking about is like, what are the rituals or holidays or pieces of Jewish stuff that are interesting that the vast majority of Jews haven't done at all, that have no, and that's part of why we did our Shavuot Unbound piece, is because such a high percentage of American Jews who are not Orthodox have no Shavuot practice. It's not like us telling them to go online for Shavuot makes them think, how can I go online on Shavuot? Yep. Like, even though it's the same rule for Shavuot as it is for other holidays, like, they never did anything for Shavuot. And, you know, there's all these great counting the Omer things that have come up recently, and I think they succeed largely because people don't have, like, no, this is how the Omer is counted. They didn't do anything. So I think it might be that we need to think, like, what are those pieces, what are those holidays, what are those observances? We saw the success of, I would say mild success of Shemitah, the sabbatical year, being brought back by environmental groups because nobody had done anything. So saying Shemitah is going to be about environmental justice, okay, great. Like, there's no baggage there. So I'm curious, like, if we can find more of those pieces to sort of get the wheels turning, and then it's almost a metaphor that, like, the outsider rituals then start to bleed into the inside rituals, like high holidays or whatever.
Yeah. I'm putting my money on Talmud study.
Yeah.
But that's actually, I never really thought about that before, Binay, but why maybe, you know, Svar is so successful is because, like, Talmud study is not something that anyone has any baggage over, because most people, it was so foreign to them that they never even thought about it. So there's no barriers there except for the idea that I would be doing Talmud study, which just sort of sounds ridiculous. But if you can get over that, there's no other baggage about how it's to be done properly.
Yeah, I think absolutely that's right. And there's so much power. It has a very positive association. I guess it has some negative associations for some people, but for many people, it's like the most insider thing, the most authentic, real thing, the hardest thing. And a lot of that is very positive and pulls. But let me get back to Dan's question. I think part of the power of the option threes that make it, the alternatives that we create that are really exciting, is that they're created by people for whom it's life or death. And what I find, it's so hard, it's really hard to talk about this because you're painting with a broad brush and making generalities about straight people and queer people, and there are lots of straight people that are actually queer-headed, and, like, it's very hard to talk about. But I think the straight folk who are just sort of, you know, mildly dissatisfied but can tolerate probably should get together and have their consciousness-raising groups and, you know, start doing what the queer folk did 30 years ago and compare notes. But it's really not a matter of life or death for them. But as much as, for example, at Svara, we say we're radically inclusive and we mean something different than, you know, the inclusive 1.0 of the welcoming congregations. I don't know. Are we really that inclusive? Do we really want everyone there? No, actually not. And we deliberately use our marketing and, you know, we're kind of edgy and irreverent and slightly offensive on purpose because we want to keep out those who, like, just can't tolerate that much edginess. And that's exactly what we want to do. I keep thinking about feminist spaces and there are lots of feminist guys out there, and it's great that they're in on the feminist conversation, but we're not yet ready to have feminist spaces that are mostly men. I just don't think we're ready for that. And we're certainly not ready for feminist spaces that are all men. There has to be some lived experience of being a female identified person in a feminist space to kind of keep it real and grounded in the experience of reality. And And that's the bind we're in these radical new spaces, especially in queer spaces, at least for Svara, that I think we've got to stay mostly queer. You know, in the queer world, I've got this scheme. There's queer number one, queer number two, and queer number three. Queer number one is, you know, you're LGBT. That's your experience. And yet you bring a critique of the mainstream into the world. Okay? So you can be LGBT and not be queer. If you're LGBT, but really what you're interested in is enjoying all the goodies that straight people have and entering the straight world and, you know, not really upending to any extent the heteronormativity of the world, but you just want your place in it, you're gay, you're not queer, and I'm not really all that interested. I mean, they're great. Love, be safe, but that's not really what I'm interested in. So queer number one is you are LGBT, but you're bringing a profound critique of the mainstream and living out the insights, living out in the world. And as you walk through the world, the insights of being an LGBT person. Queer number two is you happen to be heterosexual, but you also live out, as you walk through the world, a critique of heteronormativity. And I'm very interested in queer number two people. And queer number three is you have a critique of the world because of your insights that you've gained from being on the margin for reasons that have nothing to do with gender or sexual orientation. It's because you're not pink skin, you know, you're a person of color, you live with a disability, you have some other experience of outsiderness or marginality that gives you a profound insights. The rabbis, for me, were queer number three. And I'm interested in those people too.
Well, let me take that. I'm curious about sort of another historical and present analogy, which is the role of non-Jews. And I'm thinking back to the time of the Second Temple, as I understand it, that Judaism was actually actively proselytizing in those days. And there were many non-Jews that converted to Judaism, and they basically converted to the form of Judaism that was dominant at that time, which was Second Temple Judaism. You know, I guess they sent taxes and donations to the temple. If they were in the area, they would bring a sacrifice, you know, etc. And they were, you know, I guess not... You know, they found the idea of monotheism more compelling than whatever polytheistic religions were around at the time, the Roman Empire. And Judaism was attractive there because it was a different kind of way of practicing religion. And then there was another group of non-Jews who converted to Judaism, but they converted to Judaism and then became some of the early leading rabbis, or their children did. And granted, by that time, the temple wasn't there anymore. But I'm talking about Rabbi Akiva, for example, whose parents were converts, according to the tradition. Rabbi Meir, who himself was a convert, according to the tradition. And these are two of the most radical inventors of rabbinic Judaism in the tradition. And so it sort of seems like, you know, I kind of put them into your schema, you know, that there was the kind of queer number one kind of non-Jews who just wanted to be part of the Jewish people as it was, you know, and then there was the, I don't know if it's number two or number three kind of non-Jews who wanted to be part of Judaism, but they also wanted to change it, you know, because they had a notion that there was a lot of good in here, but there was also a lot of good in what they were bringing, and they could mix it all together and take it to a new place. And, you know, when I kind of think about us today, it sort of feels, I mean, the whole question of non-Jews in Judaism is itself an enormous question of interest to me, and I think it should be to so many others. But, you know, I think, for example, of certain kinds of ways of practicing Judaism, such as, for example, classical Reform Judaism, you know, with organs and cantorial music and such. And I feel like there's a lot of Jews who aren't really that excited about that for whatever reason, probably because many of them just don't believe theologically in some of the premises of Reform Judaism or any kind of Judaism, you know. But there are a lot of people who grew up Christian in the Episcopalian church, let's say, who are used to that kind of service and actually really love it, and they just don't connect with the Jesus thing. So it seems to me like a lot of those people would be very, very happy as Reformed Jews practicing in the classical Reformed tradition, which is struggling to find too many Jews. So why, for example, should those kind of elements of the sort of incumbent Jewish type of organizations be more actively looking for non-Jews who might convert to Judaism and participate in them? Because they would actually be very happy there. And on the flip side, you know, having sort of experienced in so many of these more radical Jewish spaces, that there are a lot of non-Jews that are some of the leaders in those spaces, you know, and that's sort of surprising to me, the way that I always grew up sort of hearing that when you think about a convert, you know, think about the zeal of a convert, you know, converts are always the most traditional. But it turns out in my experience, that has not been the case, you know, that I have met many converts who are very traditional and I've met many converts that are very radical, so much so that it's kind of made me feel like, well, what was this notion that I grew up with? It's just wrong. You know, it's that, right. And all that's to say that, of course, one thing that's to say is that we shouldn't be painting with a broad brush, that we have all kinds of every kind, you know. And like we're talking about, right? I mean, I think, and I guess I want to really honor the idea that they're going to be LGBTQ Jews who really would be very happy in existing kind of organizations if only they were to be accepted. And maybe those are what you call queer number one. And we want there to be radical openness to them and to everybody else. And at the same time, recognizing that there are going to be other kinds of LGBTQ Jews and other kinds of Jews that, no matter how radically welcoming the existing type of organizations are going to be, are not going to find their place there. Like I just was at a really innovative kind of Jewish organization recently that, you know, provides Shabbat services, and I went there and it was really very lovely. And my wife asked me how it was, and I said, you know, it was really, you know, fantastic. But it turns out that I really just don't like services, right? You know, like no matter how wonderful it is, it's not for me. And so they could be as radically inclusive as possible, and it's still not going to work for me, unless they are so radically inclusive that it kind of undermines their own central principles, which is that they do believe in services. So I want to respect the institutions. I want to respect the people who do find their place there. And at the same time, kind of explore this idea that there are people and maybe a lot of people who are really looking for something sort of profoundly different, and how to get those things created. And I guess, again, I come back to my concern that it takes a lot of pain to create those things. And how do we have those things created without inflicting pain on people?
Fortunately, there are a lot of people in pain, or at least there are enough people in pain, I think, to carry us into the next era. And I think the people who are just like mildly, you know, the ones who are operating on one cylinder and, you know, they're okay, they're not super excited. I'm not that hopeful. I'm really not that hopeful about the ones who are not in that much pain. But maybe I'm just not focusing on them or I'm not realizing the success of the innovations. I think there's probably a relationship between the ones who are not in that much pain and the sustaining innovators, and the ones who are in a lot of pain who are being more disruptive innovators. And I don't have a lot of hope for the sustaining innovations, because I think they're not getting at the depth at which the old system wasn't working.
So maybe let me put out one idea in closing, and of course we'll talk again, and we want to keep trying to get at this stuff, but you know, I'm in the mindset that a couple weeks ago, it was the fifth Yahrzeit, the fifth anniversary of the death of Steve Jobs. And, you know, I think about something that is really the story of Steve Jobs, was that some of the kind of radical innovation that became ultimately part of Apple was done by Xerox's Palo Alto Research Center, Xerox PARC. And and we're talking about the graphical user interface and the computer mouse. And these were things that were created by this kind of laboratory of Xerox that was far away from the Xerox headquarters on the other side of the country. And they didn't know how to distribute it widely. They were pure scientists. They just loved creating this stuff. And it was serving their needs to create this stuff. And Steve Jobs came in and he kind of said, oh, I see something here that could be valuable for everybody, that could transform the face of computing. And it was Steve Jobs' genius to sort of understand what he was seeing and also figure out a way to actually connect it with a lot of people, maybe without that energy of invention that was driving the scientists who actually developed these things. And I wonder if that's something that we might be thinking about as a Jewish community, because I think that we've talked about this a little in sort of the funding world, the thinking about funding of Jewish organizations. We sort of imagine that somebody who is creating something really new in the Jewish world is going to be the one who's going to scale it up. And a lot of pressure from funders is, can you bring this idea to scale? As opposed to something that I'm really trying to play with, this idea that no, that's not the job of the inventor. The inventor rarely can bring something to scale, and that's not a sign of the fact that their invention cannot be brought to scale. It's that those are two profoundly different drives and two profoundly different skills, and that actually you need both, and the inventor should be left to keep being an inventor, and the scale people should come into the lab periodically to see if there's anything here that could be brought to scale. And if we thought about, you know, investing in the Jewish community, that we might do very well to imagine that we should be funding two kinds of things. One is these radical inventive places that will never go to scale, and the other is people that have the talent to see things that could be taken out of their birth environment and brought to scale. And maybe that's getting more in the right direction.
That sounds right. I'm more hopeful that I can make a more profound and lasting change if I raise up 10 radical queer leaders to lead not just 10 radical queer communities, but 10 communities that will be open to everybody and appeal to everybody, than if I educate 100 non-radical queer folk. Does that make sense?
Yeah, and I think it actually is a nice way to connect our last two interviews, because, you know, on the one hand, I see Josh Lesser's synagogue in Atlanta as being a really significant and important thing for the people who participate in it. And it was the place that Sandra Lawson found her connection to Judaism. And she has gone on to bring Judaism to so many people through Snapchat, right? And in a certain way, Josh Lesser is responsible for this Snapchat Judaism, whatever that will ultimately become, that he did not have any intent to do, right? But because he operated in a way that also developed these individual people that have gone on, like Sandra Lawson, to take substantial roles as leaders, that isn't kind of impact that can't be measured under the normal ways of thinking about measurement, and yet they can be in retrospect.
I think that's a really important point and a great connection to make, and also the way that we are going to close this episode. We want to, as we always do, encourage you to be in touch with us, because we grow so much as a show whenever our listeners are in touch with us. So there are a few ways for you to do that. First is through our Facebook page, Judaism Unbound, and another is on our website, judaismunbound.com, where you can find show notes for this episode and all of our others. And last but not least, you can send Dan and I emails at dan@nextjewishfuture.org and lex@nextjewishfuture.org. We also encourage you to check out B'nai Lappi's wonderful organization, Svara, that's S-V-A-R-A, and they have a website, svara.org. And we're so privileged to have B'nai join us for this episode today, to have her return to this episode today, since we had her on one of our earliest. So thanks again, B'nai, for coming on.
Thank you for having me. This was fun.
And as one last reminder, we have our Patreon, which you can access at patreon.com. That's patreon.com/Judaism Unbound if you want to give us a monthly donation of any amount, even just a few dollars. And with that, this has been Judaism Unbound.